Thank you, Paul, and good evening to everybody. It's great to see you all. I'm sorry I can't kind of meet you all in person, but hopefully at some point that will be possible. I made a very slight amendment to the title for this evening. So I'm going to talk about the divine imperative of wealth creation, but I've added to that and the awesome responsibility that it brings. So the divine imperative of wealth creation and the awesome responsibility that it brings. Just a reminder of where we are and where we've got to in this exercise. The question you'll remember is, why does business matter to God? Why business matters to God? And we're trying to establish some biblical and theological principles to guide us, thinking about both the good that business does and, of course, the challenges. Given that we live in a fallen world. I'm going to share my screen and let's just see if that works. Well, where's my PowerPoint gone here? Okay. Maybe I just need to let's try that again. There we go. That's better. That hopefully, can people see that? Yep. Yeah, thank you. I saw a thumbs up. That's helpful. Divine imperative of wealth creation and the awesome responsibility. You'll see there I put up Genesis 2 verses 11 to 12. We'll come to those verses later. I wonder if I'd asked you to quote without looking it up, Genesis 2, 11 to 12. How many of you would have been able to do that? The name of the first, it's a river, is Pishon. It is the one that goes around the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold, and the gold of that land is good. And then bdellium and onyx stone are there also. We'll come to that verse later in the talk. It's rather important. It's there in Genesis 2. 11 to 12. Just a very brief reminder of where we're going over these sessions. Last month we looked at a biblical theology of work, hence Paul's question right up front. Tonight, the divine imperative of wealth creation and the awesome responsibility. Next month, we're going to look at call and vocation. And then in April, enterprise and entrepreneurship. And then in May, we're going to try and have an in-person discussion evening, assuming we can, under the rules and regs that we have to operate under at the moment. And it's just, again, just in terms of establishing where we've got to, just worth reminding ourselves of the overall aims and objectives, to understand the role of business and the economy in God's world, to appreciate the theology and biblical teaching around work, business, and the economy, and recognizing the distinctive contribution that a Christian can bring to questions of calling, ethics, and values. So what we're trying to do, we're trying to build a framework which explains in biblical and theological terms the nature of and the call to business, the nature of and the call to business in the divine economy, with all of the blessings and responsibilities which that entails. And the last slide in terms of recapping what we summarized in the last session in January on a biblical theology of work. We noted that work has intrinsic value and reflects God's glory because God is a worker. That the creation mandates demonstrate the importance of work. That all human work reflects God's character, not just spiritual work. The Bible shows the central place of work, business, and entrepreneurship. And yet the Bible also warns against both laziness and oppression. Well, all that really is just by way of recap and kind of establishing the scene as to where we've got to at this point. What we're going to do in this session is look specifically at the divine imperative of wealth creation, and then alongside that, the awesome responsibility that wealth and capital confers. In a sense, these are two sides of the same coin, and a good deal of the failure of much of the church in the area of business and economics is to think only about the responsibilities as well of wealth, and nothing at all about how that wealth is created. And I think what I want to say is both those things are divine imperatives. Yes, of course there is responsibility. Yes, of course we have to think how we discharge those responsibilities. But that is only possible if we have first understood that part of God's purpose for us in the world which he has created, is to create that wealth in the first place. It's the sort of problem government also has, does it not? You can have lots of political debate over how you spend resources, but you have also to give equal weight, if not more weight, to how those resources are generated and created. So this is what we're going to cover in the course of the next half hour. There we go. We're going to start with a reflection on morality and the market, some basic principles and moral challenges. Then we'll go into the meat of wealth creation as a biblical imperative. Then we'll flick the coin over, if you like, and look at wealth creation and spiritual responsibility. And then finally, we'll return to the question of morality and the marketplace, looking at, well, what are the theological principles, and how then, if we believe that it is a divine imperative that we use the resources that God has given us to create wealth, how then should Christians respond to the challenge of poverty and so on? So the first thing we're going to do is look then at this question of morality and the markets and basic principles and moral challenges. Now, the financial crisis, you may remember the financial crisis, the most recent one, although it perhaps depends how you define recent. I mean, the most recent one, I suppose, is the one we're in at the moment. But the financial crisis of 2007 to 2010, let's say, was, of course, not the first such crisis, nor even the first time that a bank had collapsed. But the resulting recession and crisis was deep and long-lasting, not least because it was seen that some combination of greed, abuse of power, abuse of trust, as well as the development of increasingly complex financial instruments, all contributed to the collapse. So again, you know, historical perspective is terribly important. My own children at the time of the financial crisis 2007-2010 were saying, has this ever happened before? This is a disaster. The world is ending. The world is coming to a close. And I had to explain that, well, it was neither the first, nor was it the worst. But there was a poignancy about that particular crisis because of the suggestion that what was at fault at root, was the system itself. So you can begin to see how we're going to be approaching this discussion. Is the system, the capitalist system, if you want to put it that way, the market economy, is it part of God's provision? And if it is, then we need to give due weight to that economy. And yet at the same time, we all recognize that we live in a fallen world, and therefore even those things that are God-inspired and God-ordained will not necessarily work completely as intended by God. So the outcome then of the financial crisis of the 2007-2008 was not just a financial crisis, but potentially a crisis for capitalism itself. I'm grateful that Paul recommended that book. I've not read it yet, but I will do so, because so many of the books that have come to be published over the last decade about Christianity and economics, Christianity and the economy, Christianity and business, are frankly appalling. And so many have simply assumed that it's the economic system is at fault, the economic system must be overturned, and so on and so forth. That's not a view that I take, and I think we need a much more carefully nuanced view to understand what's going on. So what can we say then about the market economy? And indeed, what about the role of government and the quest for social justice? So the American commentator and former socialist, Irving Kristol, died quite recently, a couple of years ago, said this: capitalism survives because it still satisfies the basic, simple impulses of ordinary men and women. It will not continue to satisfy them, however, without the bedrock provided by the Judeo-Christian tradition. It gives certain answers to ultimate questions that modern philosophy or modern thought of any kind cannot provide. So you see what Irving Kristol is doing there? He's talking about a market economy guided by Christian moral values. That's his argument as to what is divinely ordained. And then Michael Novak, who also actually, Michael Novak died last year. My screen doesn't seem to want to behave. There we go. So Michael Novak, in The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, wrote of all of the systems of political economy which have shaped our history, none has so revolutionized ordinary expectations of human life, lengthened the lifespan, made the elimination of poverty and famine thinkable, enlarged the range of human choice as democratic capitalism. And Novak, who's a Roman Catholic, goes on to define democratic capitalism as one essentially defined by a market economy and a free society. Now, it is difficult to contest, I would say very difficult to contest, that without the market economy, we would have made significantly less progress in the fight against poverty, and we would be living in societies that were substantially less free. Indeed, the United Nations, in its 2015 report on the achievement of its Millennial Development Goals, reported that the proportion of the world population living in extreme poverty, and it defined extreme poverty as having $1.25 a day to live on. That definition has changed slightly now. It's now $1.90. I could probably talk for an evening about how definitions change in order to make sure that you still have people in poverty, but that would be a different matter. $1.25 a day had dropped between 1990 and 2015, so 25 years, from 47% of the world's population. So in 1990, 47% of the world's population existed on less than $1.25 a day, to just 14% in 2015. A drop in proportionate terms of round about 70%. The proportion of the world's population classed as being in the middle classes had tripled. I'll mention the importance of the middle classes later, but essentially one of the ways in which, or one of the appropriate ways of responding to the challenges and complexities of inequality is actually to have an expanding middle class. Inequality in itself is not a problem. Inequality in itself is not something we've been promised freedom from. Inequality in itself has certain good aspects. However, you can all understand, and we can all understand, if you have very extreme examples of extreme wealth and extreme poverty, that clearly generates some complexities. The answer to that is an expanding middle class with the aspiration to reach into those middle classes. But we'll come back to that a little later. So all of that is meant just simply to set out that there's a clear moral case for the market. Indeed, a case that a form of the market economy is set out for us in the pages of Genesis and beyond in the scriptures. But we know, don't we, that there's a problem. We know there's a problem with the market, the problem that distorts reality and is a consequence of sin and the fall. Now, we can summarize the complexity of this problem by using the economic values survey, which was undertaken by a US-based think tank called the Public Religion Research Institute. They don't do it every year. They had some funding, and this is 2013. But it brought out some really, and you can access it online, it brought out some really interesting statistics. And this is what they found. They asked a question, this is US-based, but the principles are the same. They asked the question, the respondents, to cite reasons why they viewed capitalism was a good thing. Why did respondents think that capitalism was working? And these are the main answers, not giving every single answer. That it encourages personal responsibility, that's 33% of respondents. That it provides equal opportunities, American dream, 29%. That it promotes individual freedom, 24%. That it creates wealth, 11%. And other matters stated, 3%. Now, just try and bear that in mind, or if you've got a copy of the PowerPoint, keep it with you while we look at the next slide. Because the next question was that they asked their sample to cite reasons why they thought capitalism wasn't working. And this is what came out, that it encouraged greed at 34%, that it does not provide equal opportunities, 28%. That it creates poverty, 14%. That it creates inequalities, 11%, and 13% citing others. So you can almost see some of the mirror images of those answers. Does capitalism encourage responsibility or greed? Does it provide equal opportunities or not provide equal opportunities? Does it create poverty or wealth? That's the dilemma before us. And what I want to do is to show for us that for the Christian, wealth creation is actually a spiritual imperative, but that it carries awesome responsibilities and consequences. And only when we've had this discussion can we effectively debate how social justice is to be met and what is the role of government and so on. So let's turn to the question of wealth creation as a scriptural and biblical imperative. The basic reason why wealth creation is a biblical imperative is that it is a creation mandate. If you remember, this will take us back to those theological principles around creation which we discussed last time, and of course it's linked to that divine mandate to work. You know, work must have a purpose. There's no point having a divine mandate to work if the work is meaningless. Otherwise, God is endorsing and ordaining meaninglessness, and God would never do that because it would be contrary to his very character. So if there is a divine mandate to work, as we saw last time, there must be some form of mandate to create wealth. So just to recap what we mean by a creation mandate is something which is set out by God as part of the principles of creation and applicable for all people for all time. Different ways of characterizing these things. Some people talk about a covenant of creation and a covenant of redemption. And we as followers of Jesus Christ know both the covenant of creation and the covenant of redemption. And as followers of Jesus Christ, we long for people to come to know the Lord in redemption. But God has also acted in a covenant of creation for his whole world, whether or not individuals come to know Christ in the covenant of redemption. The Reformed theological tradition will sometimes refer to this as common grace. There's different ways in which you can describe it. But the idea is that in the pages of the creation narrative, the Lord sets down for us certain principles applicable for all people for all time. Just as an aside, this is why we don't go and camp out in tents at the top of the hill waiting for the second coming. I mean, I look forward to the second coming. I look forward to the return of Jesus, but God has given us purpose and meaning in this world. Not just go and camp out in your tent waiting for the Lord's return a week on Tuesday. That's been a common failing of many Christians. So Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, the economic creation mandate. You'll be familiar with the verse. You'll be familiar with it from last time. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. We've already worked out that this short verse has enormous implications, but it's worth just standing back and noting that this is an economic command, an economic command of God. This mandate from God is not to work for no purpose, but to harness the resources of the world, God's created world, in producing goods and adding value. This command precedes the entry into the world of sin. It precedes the fall. In other words, not only work per se, but economic productivity, wealth creation, is part of God's intention for every person. That basic idea, that basic requirement, also has significant implications for any government programs that encourage dependency rather than work, a point not lost on evangelicals in the past, which, if I have time, I will mention towards the end. It does seem lost on quite a few evangelicals today, but that's a different matter. So the first point, the economic creation mandate, Genesis 2:15. The second point is reinforcing Genesis 2:15, if you like. There is this remarkable description of what God has provided for those who work the land in Eden. And describing the Garden of Eden in its setting of verses 8 to 14 of Genesis chapter 2, we read that God had provided trees and water, but also between the headwaters of the rivers which flowed out of Eden, God provided three precious metals: gold, aromatic resin, and onyx. Let me just turn to those verses in my Bible. And the Lord God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground the Lord God made to spring up every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. There's the trees. The tree of life was in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. A river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and there it divided and became four rivers. The name of the first is the Pishon. It is the one that flowed around the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good. Bdellium and onyx stone are there. The name of the second river is the Gihon. It is the one that flowed around the whole land of Cush. The name of the third river is the Tigris, which flows east of Assyria. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. There is no question that the divine intention is that man should take those precious resources that God has provided in order to create goods and create wealth. If you take together what did it say in there, verse 12? We found the gold in the land of Havilah is good. Divine endorsement, if you like, of a crucial precious metal that makes absolute sense when the command to work follows. Put these things together: the command to work, the provision of precious stones, metals, and resins, all of which can be used in the production and provision of goods and things, and indeed in the development of entrepreneurship and commerce, which we see in Genesis chapter 4. I'll deal with Genesis chapter 4 in more detail in the session on enterprise and entrepreneurship. And also the development of skills set out in Exodus 35, 30. I've got these down here. The goodness of the goal, development of enterprise, Genesis chapter 4, development of skills, Exodus 35, 30 following. I'm not going to go into the details of Genesis 4 and Exodus 35 tonight. I'm going to do that in a couple of sessions down the line. What I'm doing tonight is giving you that picture built on the creation mandates, reminding us that God has provided the resources of the world for his people to put to good use and to create enterprise, to create business, to develop skills, and to provide goods for human well-being. In the New Testament, we see the same emphasis set out for us in the parable of the talents. Matthew 25, 14 to 30. There's various other examples one could have chosen. But as I'm sure you're aware, in the parable of the talents, each person was equipped with an amount of money related to his abilities. Just note that this wasn't socialism or communism. People weren't provided with identical amounts. And they invested the capital. And, well, at least two of them obtained a return. Their diligence was rewarded with more. The unfaithful servant was berated for failing even to put the money on deposit. Now, you could preach a full sermon about the parable of the talents and all of its lessons and all of its implications. But in essence, this parable is about our spiritual responsibility to use our gifts and talents to obtain economic returns through effective stewardship and investment. And it's a warning against an over-obsession with equality. It's back to Dorothy Sayers in the last session. The first responsibility of the Christian carpenter is not to convert the person sitting at the next desk. No, the first responsibility of the Christian carpenter is to make a good table. That's the crucial point. So, wealth creation as biblical imperative. Well, if I stop there now, everything that I have said would be true. Everything that I've said would be as set out in the scriptures, but it wouldn't be the whole truth because there is a flip side, and we must consider the flip side. And the flip side comes about because things don't always work out as perfectly as they should, due to the consequences of sin and the fall. So I want to turn now to the question of wealth creation and spiritual responsibility. We've established that the principle of wealth creation is a biblical and spiritual imperative. But if we have this wealth, and on an individual level we may or may not have, but if we have this wealth, what do we do with it? What is the responsibility of the individual with wealth and capital and the blessings that come from creating wealth? And that's not the same as saying every single person will have those blessings, but for those that do, what is the responsibility? Well, we are not called to simply give it away and become poor. That might be what is often thought, but that is not what we are called to do. That is what I call the monastic error. The history of monasticism in the Christian tradition, there are many things that are positive about that, and there's a lot of things that are negative. And among the negative things is the assumption of holy poverty, the assumption that what we're called to do is to give everything away and become poor. So that's the monastic error. That's not what we're called to do. Or alternatively, to think that all responsibility for dealing with issues of poverty lie with government. That you might describe as the socialist error, that we don't have any responsibility here at all. It's the responsibility of the government. I'll pay my taxes and then sit back. Or the monastic error, I'll just get rid of everything and live a life of poverty. It's just worth noting, there is no special morality attached to a government pound. Rather, then, the key in understanding the response to wealth lies in recognizing the variety of ways in which the New Testament deals with a key verse. And that key verse is Luke 14, 33. Luke 14, 33. So therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Oh, well, that's a bit challenging, isn't it? That kind of implies we must renounce everything to be a disciple of Christ. Indeed, it does. The question is, what did that mean in the scriptures? What does renounce mean? Well, it doesn't mean don't make a profit. We know, for example, that for some 20 years, Jesus himself worked in his earthly father's carpentry business and presumably made some good tables and presumably also made at least sufficient profits in order to be sustainable over time. We know that Simon and Andrew actually ran a fishing business with employees. If you don't believe me, look at Mark 2:20. Whenever we talk about the calling of the disciples, we always note they're fishermen. And then people always say, oh, well, the fishermen were really poor. Well, not according to Mark 2:20, because according to Mark 2:20, Simon and Andrew were employers, and therefore they ran a fishing business. Let me get it here. Mark 2:20. No, I don't mean Mark 2:20. Where's the calling of the disciples?
Mark 1.
It's Mark 1, not Mark 2. Thank you very much. Here we go. It's Mark 1:20. Yes, that's right. Notice what it says, you know, going at Mark 19 and going on a little further, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, John, his brother, who were in their boat mending the nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat and the hired servants and followed him. So actually, these were people running a fishing business. Yes, they stopped and they went and followed Jesus, and we will come to that in a minute. But we know that profitable business was part of the normal behavior at the time of Jesus. We know that the apostles left behind their homes and livelihoods, at least for a period of time. There's no suggestion, actually, they did so permanently. They followed Jesus during the course of his ministry, but there's no evidence that they sold everything off. The rich young ruler, for example, by contrast, is told to sell everything. The rich young ruler told to liquidate his assets and distribute them to the poor. That's Luke 18, 19 to 27. The wealth here clearly is a blockage, and the individual is being challenged by Jesus. But then Zacchaeus only promises half of his goods plus restitution, Luke 19, 1 to 10. Other examples, the women of Luke 8, 1 to 3, do not divest themselves of their wealth, but they use it. And they use it to support Jesus and his disciples on an ongoing basis. Paul, we know, works as a craftsman in order to support himself, Paul the tent maker, and provide for the needs of his companions and for those in need. That's Acts 20, 33 to 35. And then in Acts 16, there is the example of Lydia, who we are told was a dealer in purple cloth. Purple cloth was the most luxurious item at the time. So Lydia was a wealthy woman. She owned her own house. She welcomed the disciples in. But there's no suggestion that she saw any incompatibility between that and following Christ. So why have I told you all that? Jesus demands our all. That's the spiritual imperative. But precisely what that means spiritually for each one of us is not laid down in economic terms, precisely because of the economic creation mandate to create wealth. We are then called to act in a responsible manner with that wealth. So the creation mandate to create wealth, in the covenant of redemption, as we come to know Jesus, a challenge to us over how we use that wealth, expressed in a number of different ways. And therefore, the responsibility that we have is to act responsibly with whatever wealth, whatever it is we've been blessed with and given. So we've seen that wealth creation is a spiritual imperative, but that it also carries spiritual responsibility. So let me turn briefly in my last section again to that question of morality and the market, and just try and pick out a couple of theological principles, and we'll finish with a brief reflection on responding to poverty, and we can take that into questions if we so wish. So the Christian idea of the market is built on the following: the positive mandate to create wealth, the principle of private property, the family as the basic economic unit, the relief of poverty, accountability and judgment are part of economic life. If you're into the 19th century, the evangelicals in the 18th and 19th centuries recognized that we would face judgment in the marketplace just as much as anywhere else. It was part of the discipleship that a Christian would have. Yes, taking the blessings, but also taking some of the punishments, I suppose, and so on. And bankruptcy was one particular example seen in that light. And that moral behavior is essential to the functioning of the market and to economic justice. Now, Adam Smith, I don't think it would be right to describe Adam Smith as a committed Christian. Most people, most historians looking at Adam Smith basically consider him a sort of a deist. So sort of a kind of believed there was a God, but that was kind of as far as it went. He argued, of course, that the greatest public good was achieved through the individual pursuit of self-interest. And in this way, the market mechanism achieved the just allocation of resources. So Adam Smith isn't about greed. Adam Smith says, by pursuing your self-interest in a transaction, you achieve the satisfaction of your wants and needs, the satisfaction of the other party's wants and needs, and the greater public good. That was his argument. So it's very unfair to accuse Adam Smith of advocating greed. Now, for those of more explicit Christian faith, particularly evangelicals such as Thomas Chalmers, 1780 to 1847, interesting man in a whole number of ways, this paradox could only be explained by the providential design of those laws of economics. And so in his second volume of his work, Natural Theology, this is round about, I haven't got the date on my notes here, this is round about 1820, I think. Chalmers said that the market strongly bespeaks a higher agent by whose transcendental wisdom it is that all is made to conspire so harmoniously and to terminate so beneficially. I'm sorry about the language. It's all a bit sort of 18th and 19th century language, but you can see what Chalmers is doing. He's saying, hey, we have these market mechanisms that generally work. They allocate goods and services. They enable us to exchange one with another. The only reason that they can contribute to the public good is because they must be those as designed by God. And so historically, those in the evangelical tradition, certainly in the 18th and 19th centuries, have, for the most part, held a positive view of wealth creation and enterprise, but then have adopted the voluntary principle in dealing with poverty and disadvantage. And I've probably got time just to do a few minutes around some of this. So market principles and virtuous compassion have effectively defined this approach. Market principles and virtuous compassion. Since the market is part of God's provision, behavior, compassion, and responsibility are crucial components of a Christian vision for society. And although I absolutely think there is a proper role for government in any free and, you know, liberal democratic society and so on, of course there is. We all understand that. You can see where some of my concern for an overemphasis on the role of government comes from. It basically becomes an abdication of our own responsibility, an abdication of our own exercise of compassion and responsibility under God. Fully recognize there's a balance to be achieved, fully recognize there's a political argument to be had beyond what we're interested in this evening. But the evangelical views the market not simply as a system of resource allocation, but also as a place where discipleship is exercised or even learned. And from this comes ethics and behavior. You see, being involved in the market is the beginning of ethics. Being absent from the market is the end of ethics. So when the creativity, innovation, and dynamism of the market are combined with the voluntary principle, the result is a radical, a radical conservative approach, if you like, to the challenges of poverty. Now, we'll start with Chalmers. We'll say a word or two about Shaftesbury, and then we'll finish. Now, for Chalmers, government intervention, and I do it in that order because Chalmers came first, and government was sort of late 18th century. Government wasn't very developed anyway, so he tended to have a more negative view. For Chalmers, government intervention was not only unnecessary, but in his view, arrogant, as it sought to usurp the creator from his rightful position. In addition, he said, any extensive role for the state had the effect of taking over those things that truly belonged in the heart, which you might describe as the moral sentiments. Just going back to Adam Smith, what people always remember of Adam Smith for writing The Wealth of Nations in 1776, but before that, in 1759, he wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And it was about those sentiments that reside in the human heart. So Chalmers, quoting again from Natural Theology, again, I apologize about the language, but you pick up the gist. We cannot translate beneficence into the statute book of law without expunging it from the statute book of the heart. That's my point about if we allow government to get too big, if we allow taxation to get too extensive, we sit back and say, it's not our problem, government will sort it out. Chalmers strongly adopting that view. We cannot translate beneficence, those moral sentiments, those compassions, into the statute book of law without expunging them from the statute book of the heart. He understood that the nature of the human person was not as a depository of rights. See, everything today is discussed in terms of rights. Chalmers understood that an individual has a will, a conscience, a moral personality, and duties and responsibilities. The intervention, he argued, of the state had led to duties being replaced by rights, to dependency rather than freedom. Well, perhaps Chalmers and Lord Shaftesbury, 1801 to 1885, might say a bit more about him when I come and visit. Probably the key historical figures who adopted the principles of the market and the voluntary principle. And with Shaftesbury, it was the development of literally thousands, a network of thousands of voluntary societies, visiting societies, savings clubs, loan societies, example there of microfinance in action, poor relief societies, savings banks. I'm writing something at the moment about the history of penny banks, savings banks, building societies, friendly societies, all designed to encourage those Christian moral principles of prudence and thrift. And these proliferated in the 19th century under the sponsorship of evangelicals such as Lord Shaftesbury. So you take a female flower seller outside Waterloo Station. What is she to do in the winter when the flowers aren't available for her to sell? So Shaftesbury put together a group of philanthropists, they established a fund, and they would make loans to the flower sellers to enable them to buy an oven in order to sell roasted chestnuts. And they would be provided with a loan, which they would repay at a penny a week. You see the principle there in action. Now, these organizations were neither new nor exclusive to the 19th century, but there was then a significant expansion. And it is said that in the second half of the 19th century, 3/4 of all voluntary organizations were under evangelical patronage or control. And these societies were characterized by local control, personal relationships, and independence from state aid. The attraction of the voluntary society, Chalmers also put this into action in Glasgow, was that it enabled the proper provision of social welfare to be kept separate from the interventions of the state. It allowed a distinction to be drawn. This is a controversial point in a way. It allowed a distinction to be drawn between deserving and undeserving poverty. Chalmers sent out visitors into the districts of Glasgow, where he was the minister of St. John's Parish in Glasgow, in order to ascertain the degree to which those asking for help and assistance truly needed it, and to what extent they were responsible for it themselves. The idea was to provide temporary assistance, not a permanent dependency. Well, we must finish. Let me draw some conclusions. Let me just go on to my last slide. Wealth creation then is a divine imperative, but it carries awesome responsibility. John Wesley, in his sermon on money, said, earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can. Earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can. He didn't see those as contradictions at all. So let me finish with just three principles, which might just help us in thinking about where we might invest whatever blessings God has given us. And I've just got three very brief ideas, which I'll just put up. First, invest. Invest for the long term. You might be investing a skill that you have. You might be investing in a microfinance initiative or a social enterprise. You might just be investing in Christian work. But invest if you have the capacity to do so. Secondly, educate. Teach the church about the value of the business enterprise and teach the commercial world the value of faith principles. In a sense, that's what I do all the time through my think tank, CME. So put some money into investing, put some money and effort and commitment into educating, and then do a little bit of just giving to God, to church, to family, to those in need, to gospel work, without strings. Just three ideas, really, at the end of this talk as to how those of us who have been blessed with whatever we're blessed with might invest, might seek to educate, and might give. But there we are. I'm sorry I've gone on just a little too long. The divine imperative of wealth creation and the awesome responsibility that it generates.
Thank you very much, Richard.